nagging. Naturalist. It's the Nagging Naturalist Podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this newest segment of the Nagging Naturalist Podcast. So new, I don't think I even have a name for it yet. Basically, what I'm hoping to do is do a segment where I periodically update you guys about what's going on in the world of wildlife. Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be related to the animal of the month, it's just general wildlife news. So my goal with this is to share with you any really cool stuff that's going on, like newly described species, new discoveries, rare findings, and really interesting animal events. And in some cases, like today, just a little update as far as some of the cool things, like the fact that it's Ape Awareness Month and National Frog Month. Frogs are a very important group of amphibians. If you heard my first episode for the Animal of the Month, the Hellbender, you learn about amphibians as bioindicators, specifically the Hellbender. Frogs are also bioindicators within their habitats. Not all frogs. There are some frogs, and by frogs I mostly mean toads, which are a type of frog, can live in drier climates and may not always be indicators, and there are definitely some invasive species that are problems. But in general, though, most frog species tend to live in wet and damp areas, and they require that good water quality. So they are a really important bioindicator around the world in a lot of different types of ecosystems. A major threat that amphibians around the world, especially frogs, are facing is the spread of chytrid fungus. It is this fungus that grows all over the outside of their body, and it prevents them from respirating properly. A lot, if not all, amphibians to some degree respirate through their skin. So it's very important that their skin isn't covered in anything that mucks up that ability, essentially, which is why it can be a little tricky when people want to handle amphibians. Handling amphibians with dirty hands or oily hands can inhibit that ability, which is why people are always told to be careful when handling amphibians, because they can really damage that skin respiration process. Something that people can do this month to help frogs out is when we go to parks. Something really important we can do is to be aware of our own personal hygiene and cleanliness. And I'm not necessarily talking about showering. I'm talking about making sure that you are wearing clean clothes and making sure that you clean your shoes, especially if you go to different parks, because you can track different things like seeds and bacteria and other things from one place to another. A really simple way to help out is, one, a lot of parks tend to have these little shoe brushing stations where you can brush your shoes off in order to help clean off debris. And two, another thing you can do is when you go home, you can try to clean and disinfect your shoes. One simple thing to do is to make a shallow bleach solution. I think the recipe is about a quart of water to a couple tablespoons of bleach. Typically, it'll tell you on the bottle how to make a sanitizing solution with bleach. Usually anything that's food grade safe is safe enough to sanitize your shoes without having any negative effect on it. But making sure that you're keeping your shoes nice and clean and you're not tracking things between these natural spaces can really help protect the health of ecosystems and animals like frogs. So that's a small and simple thing you can do this month if you're able to visit parks this month, unfortunately. Moving over to apes. So some of you are probably familiar with apes. Making sure that we are not confusing them with monkeys, apes are the groups of primates that do not have those long tails. Monkeys, being the very arboreal creatures that they are, tend to have those long tails for balance, and to some degree they might also be prehensile for hanging in trees. Apes don't have that. While there are definitely arboreal apes, they have found other ways of adapting to the tree life without that long tail. Most of us are very familiar with the greater apes, so that's us, gorillas, chimps, bonobos, and I'm missing someone. Orangutans. Orangutans is the other one. There are also lesser apes, such as gibbons, which are one of the more commonly recognized lesser apes. And this is a very important group because, unfortunately, a lot of our apes are endangered to some degree. Our orangutans, the gorillas, they're highly endangered species that really deserve our protection. So there are a couple of things we can do to help them out, because one major thing a lot of these apes are facing is habitat loss. For the great apes in Africa, particularly the central part of Africa, which would be your gorillas, chimps, and even some other species that are affected by this, like okapi, which are also endangered, they are affected by the mining of coltan. Coltan is a mineral that's used in a lot of electronic technology, like our cell phones. And so something you can do is, if you have cell phones and other electronic devices, you can recycle them through EcoCell. EcoCell is a program that is trying to remove some of these precious minerals and recycle them back into the technological cycle to make sure that we're not mining for new minerals and damaging more of this habitat, because that is a huge threat to gorillas and chimpanzees that live in those regions, is the mining. As far as other ones go, a really big one for orangutans, which again is another highly endangered ape, is the stripping of land for palm oil. When they grow palm farms, what they do is they do a slash and burn technique where they slash down the forest and burn it, and then they grow a monocrop, which means just one, and that's just the palm trees they use to get palm oil. The best way to help out with this is to do one of two things. One is to avoid products that have palm oil in it. And two, if you are going to purchase products with palm oil in it, which to be fair is a lot of modern food products, then we can look for round table sustainable palm oil. They look into the practices of palm oil farms around the world, and they can certify individuals who meet sustainability standards that are having less of an impact on native environments and wildlife. So these are some things we can do this month to show our appreciation and our awareness of these endangered species and the threats that they face. I don't want to dwell on this too much, though, because the goal of this segment is to bring up something positive. And what I'm actually very excited to share is last month, about mid-March, I believe it was, they released publications about two new species of six-gill saw sharks that have been officially described. Now, sharks are really great ambassadors for the ocean because they really highlight how little we understand of it by the fact that we are still discovering these large, charismatic species in the ocean because we really haven't explored as much of it as people tend to think. Roughly, we discover a new species of shark every year, at least one, if not more. And this year, we can already say that we discovered and described two new species of shark. So originally, within the saw shark group, we only knew of one species of six-gill shark. So the genus is called Pleotrema, and that's just the six-gill saw sharks in general. That doesn't include other species of saw sharks. The first species that was described was Pleotrema warreni, Warren's six-gill shark. Now we have Pleotrema anae, which is Anna's six-gill shark, and Pleotrema kaje, which is Kaja's six-gill shark. What's really cool about these guys is they are two really unique types of adaptations rolled up into one. One, they have six gills. And in case you didn't know, the average shark typically has about five gills. As far as I know, there are only anywhere from 40 to 50 species of shark that have more than five gills that we know of, which means out of the 500 plus species of sharks we have in the world, again, that we know of, then only about 10% of them have more than five gills. So it's an uncommon trait. It's typically considered primitive because it's seen as a leftover adaptation from a bygone era when sharks were more common and this was a more common trait. And of course, there is the other very obvious cool trait, and that's the fact that they have a saw basically growing out of their face. If you've never seen a saw shark or their distant cousins, the saw fish, which are in the ray family, these guys have very shark-like appearances in their body. They have that classic torpedo shape, although they are a bit on the slender side. Gray top, white bottom, same arrangement of fins for the most part, two dorsals, a pair of pectoral, pelvic and anal fins, claspers if they're males, and their caudal fin or tail. However, these guys have this nice additional appendage hanging off their face, which is basically, it looks like somebody pinched the end of a shark's rostrum, which is sort of like their nose area, but not really, and pulled and stretched it out. And then they have these specialized scales that are growing out of each side that look like teeth. Thus the name sawfish. Or sorry, not sawfish, that's their cousins. Thus the name saw shark. And what's really cool about this adaptation is that rostrum, that long rostrum, while it looks like a weapon and it can certainly be used as one, it has a cooler function than being used as a weapon, and that's that it's a life detector. All sharks and rays, and I believe also the chimeras, have this really cool adaptation called the ampullae of Lorenzini. And basically what that is describing is a network of pores that are filled with this special sensitive jelly-like substance in it that is sensitive to the natural electric pulses that living organisms give off. If you have a heartbeat or you can flex your muscles, you can produce a little bit of this electrical pulse that sharks can sense. So if you are a flat fish like a flounder trying to hide under the sand, this saw shark, when it sweeps its rostrum across the sand looking for food, it can detect the heartbeat or the minute movements of this flounder under the sand and be able to consume it, basically. And it's the same thing for saw fish, too. If you've ever seen saw fish, which I have at my aquarium, and they are gorgeous animals, they use the same adaptation in the same way. Now, they did not diverge from the same saw-faced shark or ray ancestor. This is an example of convergent evolution, which means these two animals just happen to evolve the same adaptation, which is insane and amazing, if I'm being completely honest. You know, it's one thing when birds and bats both have wings, and we use that as a common example of convergent evolution. They both have wings, but they're not related to each other. They just happen to develop this specific adaptation to help them fill an ecological niche that they were working towards throughout their evolution, basically. It's a mixture of chance and hard work, basically. Same thing with these saw sharks and sawfish, though, is that these two really unique species develop this really insane adaptation. And what's crazy about it, too, is while there aren't a lot of other fishes, and by fishes I mean the bony fish, not the cartilaginous fish, which is what the sharks and rays belong to, but the bony fishes, the common ones we think of, things like tuna, goldfish, and all those things, it's not uncommon for some other fishes to also have these long snouts sometimes too. Not for the same reasons, but it is kind of interesting, some of the really unique adaptations that some animals develop and the reasons why. I'm not going to go into this whole tirade, though. This is a completely separate rant for another day. I'm hoping to keep this a little brief. Now, if you have seen a sawfish and you're wondering what the difference between a sawfish and a saw shark is, well, we'll start off with a major difference between sharks and rays, because there are rays that look extremely shark-like. Not all rays are flat. There are rays with very robust bodies, like the sawfish, like guitar fish. They are sometimes very hard for people to distinguish from sharks. And there's a very simple way to do this. Let's ask where their gills are. If you've ever looked at an angel shark, they're very flat and ray-like, but their gills are on the side of their bodies. It's behind their face and in front of their pectoral fins, which is the first big set of fins on the bottom side of their body. If you look at any shark, really, the gills are basically all in the same place, behind the head, in front of the pectoral fins. If you look at all rays, their gill slits are on the bottom, on their ventral side, what you would imagine would be their chest, basically. It's always on the bottom. That is the easiest way to tell sharks and rays apart. There are other notable differences, but this, to me, is one that's very simple, is if you can easily see the gills on the side of their body, it's obviously a shark. If you can't see the gills, it's probably on the bottom. Another notable difference between saw sharks and saw fish is the really neat set of barbels that saw sharks have. It looks like this very long pencil mustache, basically, coming off their rostrum. Sawfish don't have that. These barbels are only found on the saw sharks. So that's another really easy way to tell the difference between these two animals, especially if you ever look at pictures of them. It might seem like they're very easy to mix up and confuse, but to be fair, there are some pretty simple ways of telling them apart. Anyway, I'm going to wrap this up now because, again, I don't want this to be too long. I just wanted to give you guys a fun little update about the wildlife world and some of the cool things going on. If you have any questions, comments, or anything like that, please feel free to reach out to me. My email is thenaturalist@thenaggingnaturalist.com, and my website is thenaggingnaturalist.com. You can find me on social media as well. I'm on Facebook and Instagram under the name The Nagging Naturalist, and my Twitter handle is @nag_naturalist. And also, since I did kind of bring up a little bit about conservation organizations and ways to protect some of these species, if you know of any really cool conservation initiatives for apes or frogs that you want to share, please feel free to let me know. I do plan on making at least another one or two new segments throughout the remainder of April, and I would love to be able to tell people about other things that they can support or even actions they can do, especially since some of us have a little bit of extra free time this month. Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you for, you know, all the support I've gotten so far from the start of this podcast. I know it's a little small and there's lots of really great podcasts that you can like marathon like 100 episodes, and I'm not quite there yet, but I appreciate those that have, you know, shown me support so far and those that participated in the recent giveaway I did too. And stay tuned because there will be another giveaway for the month of April, and I will be releasing details about that in a bit. I'm currently working to get that set up with a couple of really awesome individuals that I know. But again, thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you guys next time.